If you say that taste is objective, doesn't that go against the idea of the gut reaction? As you were describing it, you're alone with the work, you look at it, you can't decide, do I like it or don't I? It just exists whether you like it or not. And also, in terms of objective, over the long run, yes, it is objective, connoisseurship and so on. But at the moment when you're judging it, is it objective? How does that coincide with the idea of...
A gut reaction could be an objective one. Yeah.
No, I don't see
it. Well, why shouldn't it be?
It's coming out of you.
That's true, but you, as Kant says, in accord with humanity. You may say, what he meant was, we're made pretty much alike on general lines. And it's the general lines that come in play when we develop our taste. The more you develop your taste, the more impersonal you become. Not the less individual.
You're a very fine seeing apparatus at that point.
I don't want to put it that way because you're getting more satisfaction than an apparatus would get. You're not just passing something on. Yeah. You're getting it for yourself at the same time. Yeah, Tom, what's bothering you?
Well, an analogy would be if you're writing. Your criticism is good because intelligent people read it and like it and can make something out of it. But
that's
if
it's any good, it isn't for that reason.
That's how you can define good. It's when you put it to some sort of test. When intelligent people can
well, let's say I'd hope that people who can see art read it and find that what I say. Will agree with it in large part and find where they disagree that at least it's relevant disagreement. I can only point to my reading Roger Fry and disagreeing with him almost half the time and yet admiring him more and more even when I disagree with him because what he says is right on the line. There's the very visitation. He points to the thing and says, well, this is what I like about it. And there you have that chance to sharpen your own eye, if you have the chance to see the work of art itself.
But it's you at that point that makes Fry objectively good,
me among other people.
Well, yeah, that's what.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah.
So it's posterity who looks back that.
That's what I said.
Except that is not that when an appreciation of something can make it objectively good, that's not objectivity.
In the strict sense, no, but it's worked out objectively. I grant you that. In the strict sense, no. And that's the peculiarity of art, that you have what seems opinion but isn't opinion, that has all the traits of, let's say, subjective opinion, and yet is not. And you say that's a paradox. I call it antinomy. Yeah. And it's something, it's one of the reasons nobody can define art, nobody can describe the experience of art or the making of art. There it is, this area where we recognize things and feel things and react to things, and we can't straighten anything out with logic. Yeah. We can't straighten anything out by saying A can't be both A and non-A. Mm-hmm. You know, where the laws of contradiction don't apply. Last night, that's part of why that's the almost, in one way, you can say in a sense that's the main reason why art's there.
Right.
In one sense,
you've been talking about taste as in context of appreciation. I'd like to ask you a question about the role of taste in creation. Specifically, does the function of cultivated taste in appreciation have an analogous function in art in creation?
I think very much it does.
Well, could you...
expatiate on this?
I didn't want to use that. That was exactly the word.
Well, I wanted to take that up later.
Okay.
I mean, next Tuesday, because I think it's the question of taste in the creation of art is extremely important. It's crucial and it's decisive. It's not all decisive, but it's decisive in part.
Well, could I ask you one small question that might anticipate it? Get this anxiety off my mind. Would you agree that no great artist was born dumb, and no great artist ever had really bad taste?
I'm going to anticipate.
In terms of art.
Yeah, I know. You mean dumb in terms of art? Yeah. I'm going to anticipate myself and say. This, I was saving this because I wanted to. Well, I might as well. The record shows that nobody ever made important art, as far as we know, without having assimilated through his taste the best art of the moments previous to his own. Whether immediately previous, at least immediately previous, maybe. Moments less than a minute, but there's no example that we know of an artist making important art who was unable to appreciate, let's say, the art, the best new art of the generation before his. And this seems to me such an obvious truth that no one has bothered to notice. And there it is written all over the past of Western art. It's written all over the past of Chinese art, of which we have a pretty good record. And it comes in this question very appositely. For the explanation of why I come back to the most advanced looking art of this time, why it incorporates the paradox of being the academic, so academic. Mr. Lenz?
To go back to objective and subjective, the way those terms were being used, I couldn't tell whether you felt that they were absolute terms, whether the man of good taste, excellent taste, was absolutely objective, or there was a question of a mix between subject and object. Is this sort of an androgynous movement back and forth, or is it?
It isn't either or.
I think some of our confusion was feeling that objective was absolute.
Well, it's like leaving Aristotelian logic and going over into some other kind where opposites are not mutually exclusive but fade into one another. In the given individual, taste is never entirely objective. It's somewhat objective, depending, on how the extent to which he's developed his taste.
Yeah.
And we never find out until afterwards. I think in our time we've seen that taste comes closer to objectivity the more Catholic it becomes. Now that seems a contradiction. It becomes more Catholic, at the same time more discriminating. But when I say Catholic, I mean you're able to like African art, and you're able to like Oriental art, and you're able to like pre-Columbian art, and you're no longer confined to Western art, or no longer confined to Renaissance and post-Renaissance art. You're no longer in that, and also you're able to see the virtues of untutored art, which admittedly are lesser virtues, but
virtues in bad art also?
Yeah. What used to be considered hopeless art.
Wouldn't this admission of
a grading
answer the question that was thrown at you as to when you became objective? And you then able simply to reply, well, just the more I work, I become more objective.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I got trapped by that question. I got taken unawares, and then I began to get very subjective in answering and say, well, and I began to go into autobiography somewhat illegitimately. And I said, when I got on the level with other people about my reaction to it. Because I remember a time when I was ashamed to say I didn't like certain things that people whose taste I respected liked. And that's an experience I think we all had. And being ashamed to say you like something, conoscenti, don't like. Do you know what I'm talking about? I'd say, so autobiographically, I'd say the moment when I stopped being ashamed and scared, I thought that I was beginning to be objective. Not completely so, but I was on my way, I hope, anyhow.
I wonder what innovation and originality, how they flavor quality.
That's next week too, because that takes more than one evening. And, I know there's a well-founded aversion to thinking that newness is necessary to quality and art. It's well-founded, but it's not justified. You look back, and you see good art always came along with newness to some degree as an indispensable agreed factor, to some degree, or let's say individuality. You know, every human being is a unique individual. And to some extent, the quality of the individual artist's work depended on the extent, the degree to which he managed to get his individuality into his art. But see, that takes us through many other questions. Patrick?
As a critic, are you interested in settling present and current disputes of taste? And if you are, how would you propose resolving
these? Let me say first, you only resolve disputes of taste for yourself, not for other people. There's no arguing other people into agreement with verdicts of taste. All you can do is, in effect, urge them to look at the work of art we disagree about. Take another look at it. Look at it again repeatedly. But contemporary art, of course, challenges taste more than any other kind, as we know. there hasn't been time for things to, for people to look, relook, look again. And so the mistake, the frequency of error is much higher. As we know, I'm stating something very obvious. But that's precisely the fun about contemporary art, and this is all off the subject. The fun of it is matching your taste against new art, you know, and taking a chance. You know, it's easy going to a museum where everything's certified, relatively easy, and say, well, all right, I like this Rembrandt, but I don't like that Rembrandt. So, relatively easy, I don't think. And it's easy to look, see a Titian or a Veronese and find out for yourself how good it is and feel safe in enjoying it without any qualms. There's the nameplate, Veronese, you know, to reassure you. If you haven't looked at it in advance, as most of us tend to do, including myself. But when it's the new stuff comes up, and there you take a chance, see? And I find that it's exhilarating to take that chance, go out on a limb, you know, and feel it creeping, you know? And I can't see how any self-respecting art critic can resist that kind of fun. But I can see at the same time why it scares you. Well, the fright is part of the fun. With contemporary art, you're so alone. You know, you don't have any books to help you. You don't have any print to help you. You're all alone with it. And you might come to certain examples of contemporary art that have already been denounced in the art magazines and newspapers. And you find, well, you go for it very much, and here all the print is against you, and maybe all the talk is against you, and yet you're stuck with your reaction. As I said the other night, if you're on the level with yourself, you're stuck with that reaction. You can't change it just because everybody disagrees with you. And if you have qualms and you go back and look at the given work of art and you still find that you like it and everybody you know of doesn't like it, and you go back again and you like it, and maybe you like it even more, and people keep on saying it's no good. Well, that's, I tell you, you get scared, but it's some fun. You know, it is. It's the only risk is, people say you don't know what you're talking about. You can't see. You're an ass. That's the only danger. Well, I guess that's a huge, you know, like, that's a huge danger. It can bulk that way. But I find after a while you acquire a taste for being out on a limb. As a matter of fact, you get uncomfortable when other people get out on the same one. You look for another one to get out on, you know? And I can only repeat, I don't understand how any self-respecting art critic can resist that kind of adventure.
Well, how far back do you have to go before that ceases to be an adventure and begins to be ignorance?
I don't know. I mean, the record doesn't give a conclusive answer there. See, that's a quantitative question, you know. How far back do you have to go? Well, let's say, in the case of artists who are rediscovered, artists of the past who are rediscovered, sometimes, well, no, you can go back to Romanesque sculpture, which wasn't appreciated very much 100 years ago, and is now highly appreciated. Well, you say, well, who? You had to go back close to 1,000 years. And I don't see where the question ignorance comes in. But you could, I suppose, in the 1850s, be considered blind for liking Romanesque sculpture.
Well, since you've more or less separated appreciation of past works of art into objective
no, I
quality.
Haven't. I haven't separated. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, excuse me, but in talking about the general human, say, Kantian conception of what good art is or what appreciating it is over the period of centuries, at what point, let's say, if you happen to find yourself with really disliking a work of art that the educated consensus maintains is great, does that mean that you should go out and hang yourself? Or what do you do with that feeling? What do you do with that
Oh, you find that happening to you often.
But is that ignorance? Is that
No. That, too, is part of where you have to dare to be on a level. Be honest in reporting the reaction. That happens to all of us and happens all the time. That we go to past art that's hallowed and celebrated, and we find that we don't like this given work of art. And yet, everybody says, all the authorities say it's great. Well, I feel that in that case, you assume you're not seeing well enough, and you go back and look at it again. And you go back and look at it again, and you go back and read it again, and you go back and listen to it again, and see what happens. Sometimes, and it's very rare, because the authorities tend to be pretty right about the past within the limits of the past they look at. Because people writing about ancient Egyptian art in 1870s simply excluded it, and they were wrong. But they may have been right in writing about, they usually were, by and large, writing about, say, Renaissance Italian sculpture. And my point clear, you know, within the limits. But every once in a while, in my case, it's Michelangelo's sculpture. Now, I brought up to think of Michelangelo as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, sculptor in post-medieval Western tradition. And I looked, and I didn't like him, and I looked, and the more I looked, the less I liked Michelangelo as a sculptor. And I find myself stuck with that. And I look again, because I think, well, I can't, Wyndham Lewis and I can't be right and everybody else wrong. And, but the more I look at Michelangelo's sculpture, the less it becomes, the more things I see wrong with it. Quite differently from his painting. I think he was an infinitely better painter than he was sculptor. And though he was a bad decorator, I'm like, Donna. And there are examples like that, and I may still, you know, or the anyone who disagrees with the whole weight of authority. You know, well, He's liable to feel nervous. Nervous about reactions he can't help having. But that's part of the fun of art too. It is the fun of art. Part of the fun of art is knowing that this is your experience and nobody else's. You're not getting anything secondhand. It's all firsthand.
Do you think the closer an artist in working becomes, or closer to a kind of objectivity about past art and contemporary or immediately contemporary art, or gets the more eclectic he becomes? Or is that sort of vague in my question?
Yeah, it's, why should it follow? Why should it follow? You mean the more Catholic you are in your taste as an artist, the more Catholic your art gets, more, you know, the more
heading. No, I don't think I mean Catholic. I guess if that's,
well, that's what's equivalent. That's,
yeah.
I want to go into that next week about how the artist operates here, according to the record. And it's not that simple. Well, it's not that simple because great artists will come along who can see the best new art of the previous 25 years, and the previous 50 years, and then blank out over the large areas of the past.
Does the immediate aesthetic experience also require, like, I don't mean to split it intellectual from emotional, but judgment, you know, when you're hit by something, it's not, do you know what I mean?
Well, I said last night that the verdict is right in there. The judgment is right in the experience. You can't separate it. You may not be aware of the fact you've made a judgment, but there
after,
it is.
After
it's right.
You can separate it, right?
Well, afterwards, as you remember the experience, right, then the judgment tends to come clear. Mm-hmm. That's why, as I said last night, and then once again I refer to Kant, who contradicted himself, by the way. I want to warn you. I think Kant was the greatest philosopher of aesthetics of all, but he also contradicted himself like mad, especially towards the end of the Critique of Aesthetic Judgment. But Kant said that, in effect, we have to like a work of art before we can enjoy it. And he proved that quite logically. And you know, when you first read that, you say it's preposterous. And then the more you think about it, the less preposterous it becomes.
Does pure taste always automatically lead you to quality art?
Well, pure taste is something ideal. Nobody has yet
good
exhibited.
Taste in the long run, in a larger proportion, leads you to quality art over time.
Well,
so
that's
would that be a good definition of taste?
Yeah, well, I mean, you of course. How else do you recognize good taste except, you know, it's a circular definition.
Just occurred to me, huh?
That's how good taste shows itself.
I have real problems then with time and taste and quality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Time, it seems like taste gets trapped in time.
It does.
And that is the quality of.
Right.
Taste.
And then what happens, you know, it disappears. Doesn't taste sort of become irrelevant then in, you know, taste of 100 years ago or 50 years ago? Doesn't the taste of that time become irrelevant to our viewing, our looking back at that art?
It would. It almost should, you know. But we noticed that 100 years ago, people like Corot, certain people like Corot more than they did any other contemporary painter. And so we look back, we recognize Corot, I think we ought to, as one of the three or four greatest painters of the 19th century, if not the very greatest. And we say, well, these people in 1870 were right. So how can we say that taste no longer obtained?
Because all we're interested in at this point, looking back, is the quality, isn't it?
That's right, and they saw quality. That's why they said Gros was such a great painter, is on the basis of his quality.
The taste is then much more often wrong, at least popular taste.
Yeah. But I said those were try hardest and look longest and so forth. And they were always a minority in every period, apparently, or in almost every period, are the ones who end up by deciding. They're the ones who decide things. You know, here you have the Pope, Julius II, preferring Michelangelo and Raphael to, let's say, Piero di Cosimo, who was getting more commissions in Rome at that time, the beginning of the 16th century. And Piero di Cosimo was by way of being a great painter himself. But he was it was as though Michelangelo and Raphael had gotten too new for the abbots and the corporations that handed out commissions for paintings in monasteries and paintings in churches. And they'd prefer to stick with Piero di Cosimo, who was a little more 15th century. And it took these highbrows in Rome, Cognoscenti as they were called, and after the Vatican was crawling with what we call intellectuals now, and real far out highbrows. And they were the ones, including the Pope, who said Michelangelo and Raphael. So, and it's their taste that counted. They tried harder than the abbots in Florence or the trustees of the, whatever they were, the churches.
Maybe this is going ahead a little bit, but what accounts for the fracturing of taste now in terms of people not accepting, you know, quality as it's been set down previously?
Yeah, well, you know, the other night I said I couldn't answer that question in a different form. Why did good new art get more readily accepted before the middle of the 19th century than it has been since? And I really can't explain it. And I've not read any explanation of it. And
do you think it has to do with the function?
I'm sure there are all sorts of reasons, sociological reasons, economic reasons, whatnot, that play a part here. But I don't know which are the decisive ones.
Well, we can put it this way. Would you say that the class which consumes art or consumes the best art today, is it analogous with the class that, say, consumed the best art in the 15th, 16th century?
Well, that's the question. Well, it doesn't seem to be analogous.
So,
it doesn't seem to be analogous.
To me that artists today bicker among themselves on issues of taste in the same way that the class which was shocked by Monet bickered with the new art of the time. And there was a class which merely consumed. Today the struggles of taste are within the art world itself, but mostly dominated by artists. We're not concerned. I mean, artists in that sense are shocked by Norman Rockwell, let's say. There's a world which consumes Andrew Wyeth, who may be somewhat analogous to Norman Rockwell, although perhaps a better.
Yeah, he's a better.
I don't think so, by the way.
Somewhat better. They come from the same stylistic school, as you know.
I mean, there are people who consume Wyeth whose interests do not bear on the level of quality that I think we are engaging here, discussing here. It's a different...
Yeah, but look, the opposition to the Impressionists in the early 1870s made itself most evident in the newspapers and the respectable-looking people who visited the shows. In actual fact, the artists of Paris were just as violent against the Impressionists as the bourgeoisie. And I'll never forget at the Artists Club in New York back 15 years ago when they were having a series of symposia on critics and people getting up to say how awful critics were and so forth. And an old man named Ari Stillman, he was in his 70s then, he's died since, he was in his 80s, got up, and he'd lived in Paris in the early 1900s, and he said, "What's all this talk about critics?" He said, "The most ferocious opponents of Cézanne during the time in which I lived in Paris were artists." He said they were far, you know, far more opposed, far bitter about Cézanne than any art critic. He said.
Well, that would put it on the level with some things that went on in the 16th century.
Yeah, and there you are. See, it's not just the patrons who, let's say, resist and it's not just the patrons of art, the public at large, or the art public at large. It's most artists of a given time. What was different before Manet's time or before Delacroix and Corot's? Why it was different? I come back to nobody is satisfactory in explaining. There are a lot of glib explanations. Of course, I mean, it's been said until the bourgeoisie came into the ascendant, art was under the protection of aristocrats. And aristocrats weren't as vulgar as bourgeoisie or businessmen, and had time and to cultivate their taste and also more confidence, being aristocrats and so forth. That explanation doesn't satisfy me because if you look all the way back, you'll find that businessmen were prominent among the patrons of art from the 15th century on. And it wasn't just the aristocrats or the all rulers, the princes or kings or cardinals. They're also grubby businessmen. As a matter of, you know, the boards or whatever you call them of the churches in Florence that put out commissions were composed of businessmen. So,
Isn't there a real weakness in art in the fact that so few people decide, for example, if you write a book or if you do a record, it's open to the public. There's only one painting, only so many people who buy paintings, and they have a tremendous amount of power, which becomes often very jaded, I think.
Jaded power. That's good, jaded power. I have to remember that. I didn't mean to make fun of it, but I couldn't help but say that. I do know that the idea that art gets control is a myth. It's a myth. Critics don't control art, dealers don't, rich collectors don't, museums don't. I haven't seen it. My time. I've been around New York art for 30 years. I've never seen anything that, in the way of art, get control for more than 6 months, if that. And it's one of these conspiratorial myths that the mind seems to find reassurance in. It seems to be something, I don't say in all human beings, in all societies, but not society.
Well, a man like Skull, doesn't he?
Who?
Skull said. I mean, a collector like that. I mean, he created, he had a lot to do with creating a whole market or a whole interest in an area.
So it said. The evidence isn't there at all. He got on, he was very quick to get on board bandwagons. And you could see it happening. And some of the bandwagons crumbled under him, you know? So he'd get off them fast. I mean, after all, if he could control things that well, He should have been able to just pick an artist and say, well, I'm going to make you. It didn't turn out that way. He had to have opinion on his side. And you can say bad opinion, short-term opinion, fashionable opinion. But it was opinion, and it wasn't controlled or engineered opinion. Pop art was spontaneously like, when it came up around 1960. Nobody engineered that.
I think there's something unhealthy in the fact that there are so few people who are really involved in deciding about art and buying art, as opposed to people reading books. The audience for Saul Bellow is very much more egalitarian than the audience for any artist.
Have you thought about this a lot?
Yes.
Well, you find out that since the beginning of urban culture, 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, it was only the relative few that enjoyed high culture anywhere where there were cities. And that's a sad fact. It's not something I approve of. That happens to be. Most people were too busy working hard or living uncomfortably or whatever it was to enjoy art on a high level in urban societies. Now this is I'm so far from being the first one to say that. You know, it's a truism. Since Marx, anyhow, you know, the recognition of this is a truism.
Sir, 5 minutes.